Before I begin, a lot of my experiments require a lot of physical help, and I just want to acknowledge everyone at the University of Georgia, the USDA, and ABAC for their assistance with all of my studies. As some of you may know, I was brought into Stanley Culpepper's lab to see if we could determine whether wind-mediated pollen dispersal can move the glyphosate resistance trait in Palmer amaranth across the landscape, and if it can, the degree to which it's spreading. Is it simply moving within fields, between fields, or even between counties and states? Now, those of you who were at my talk last year, I described how we were going to do this in a kind of coarse way, that we could determine the theoretical maximum dispersal distance by looking at how high particles are moved into the air, how fast they're being moved laterally, and how quickly they settle out in response to gravity. This is a physical model. This strictly describes how something moves. It doesn't take into account the fact that these are living organisms and that their biological status changes over time. So does it really matter how far a pollen grain can move if it isn't able to germinate and fertilize a female flower when it finally arrives at its final destination? Now, this is not how where these numbers do not represent true numbers. This just suggests a theoretical situation. If pollen grains at the red circle are only 10% viable, is that going to affect how we manage or how we change or the kind of recommendations that we provide to farmers? Most of the models of pollen dispersal out there aren't designed to join biological data with physical data, so you get a measure of how far pollen moves and then an estimate of viability at its landing. What we hope to do is change that and actually make a combined model. So how far pollen moves is only half of the pollen dispersal story. The pollen viability is the flip side of that coin, and that's what I'm going to discuss today. The other data about pollen movement and pollen dispersal is going to be presented at the Southern Weed Science Meeting and at the WSSA and in a paper we're preparing for Weed Science. So how do we actually measure pollen viability? The easiest thing to do, short of actually putting the pollen on a plant and collecting seed, is to place the pollens on grains in a media that contains sugar and boron in a petri dish and just count how many pollen grains germinate, just like you would count the number of seeds that germinate if you want to look at the viability of a seed lot. Now, everyone knows that Palmer amaranth is a problem in the field. That's exactly the way it is in the lab. Palmer amaranth, unlike, say, 99% of all the other flowering plants in the world, doesn't have pollen that germinates on an artificial media. And it took me about 4.5 months to figure this out. So if it doesn't germinate on an artificial media, how are we going to measure viability? And the next best technique is to measure some sort of physiological or metabolic or enzymatic activity. And the easiest thing to do is to take your pollen, add a dye to it. These dyes are very specific. They have to be activated by enzymes that are functioning, and then the pollens become stained. And then you can measure the number of stained pollen grains, and that will give you an estimate of viability. So the one that we selected, and we went through a lot of stains, some of which were radioactive, so that didn't work, and some which required Stanley Culpepper to buy a $75,000 microscope, so I abandoned that one right off the bat. But we stayed with one that's called MTT, and what it is it's converted by an enzyme from a yellow color to a red-purple, and this is just perfect for us. It's not light-sensitive, it's quick, it's easy, and it's cheap. Previous studies that have been performed for other species that have used MTT to describe pollen longevity have simply scored pollen grains as being, say, darkly stained or unstained. But people all don't see color the same way. This is particularly the true with a colleague of mine at Tifton who's colorblind and couldn't visualize what I was showing him on the microscope. So what we really need is an objective measure of color to eliminate some of that error that might be associated with just lumping things into categories. The best way to do that is to take a book out of the page of how TVs work. Each color on your TV screen, each pixel, is a combination of the red, green, and blue color content. And that can be measured with a value from 0 to 255. So pixels that are, say, 000 are completely black, whereas pixels that are 255, 255, 255 are white. And that's how you get the various color spectrum that you see on a computer screen or on a TV set. So we decided to use this technology to actually measure pollen viability and color. What we did is we put pollen grains, we stained them with MTT, took a picture of them under the microscope, and uploaded them to our computer. And there's simple software out there that all you have to do is download it, highlight your pollen grain, and it will tell you what color your pollen grain is numerically based on the red, green, blue scale that the television set uses. So using MTT, we found that pollen grains appear to become less enzymatically active with time. So we decided, let's try to find out exactly how pollen viability changes over time in response to local atmospheric conditions, and then how does it change under very specific conditions that we manipulate in the lab. We'll use that data, build our model, and then describe pollen movement and pollen viability. So our first experiment was an in-field experiment where we harvested fresh pollen from Tifton on 5 days in 2007. We just exposed the pollen to prevailing environmental conditions, and every so many minutes we removed subsamples and stained them with MTT. We uploaded the images and evaluated the color intensity of 100 grains per rep. By the way, my student evaluated over 3,000 pollen grains, so there's a lot of data in this, but we'll combine it. And then we just converted the red, green, blue color values to a percent of the maximum intensity, so you can look at the decrease in viability over time. So this kind of shows how pollen color changes over time. At 0 minutes, you can see that's our most viable pollen and our most darkly staining pollen. And you can see that the color lightens over the 240 minutes. And if we change that 2% color intensity, we see that within 30 to 45 minutes, we're actually seeing a significant difference. These pollen grains are quickly becoming less viable. They're losing water. The enzymes are becoming less active. We then decided to do a similar experiment where we looked at pollen viability under conditions that we could actually manage and manipulate in the lab rather than just what was occurring that day. So we had three temperatures, we had three growth chambers that we maintained, and then we had three different relative humidities in that growth chamber, which we managed using saturated salt solutions, very simple. We pulled our pollen grains out everywhere from, say, 10 minutes to 360 minutes, stained them, and looked at the viability over time. And what we found very quickly is that pollen stainability, pollen viability, decreased with time. Pollen viability was much lower at the much later time periods, and I combined over time periods, than it was at the very early time periods. So just as we saw in the previous slide, pollen viability was decreasing with time. It also decreased with an increase in, or it, with a decrease in relative humidity. If your humidity was lower, your viability was less. At humidities close to about 100%, the pollen stayed viable for much longer. And also with temperature. The warmer it was, the less viable pollen was over the course of our experiment. And I talk like a border collie on caffeine because I'm fast, but there's a couple more slides beyond this. We chose MTT because it's cost efficient and it's stable, and it allows us to evaluate changes in the Palmer amaranth pollen over time. We found a perfect software where we're actually able to objectively measure pollen instead of subjectively. We can get numbers, we can subject them to statistics, and it's a good situation for us. We found that the enzymatic activity of freshly harvested pollen decreases with time, and we were finding significant changes, significant decrease in pollen viability within 30 to 60 minutes of exposure in the field, and that high temperatures and low relative humidity result in decreased enzymatic activity and viability. So what are we going to do with this? We're going to refine our protocols for the field and the laboratory experiments, and we're going to redo this in 2008. We are going to consider other stains so we can broaden our suite of enzymes, and we're going to look at other strategies to evaluate viability. One strategy is that you just take your pollen that's been sitting under whatever condition and sprinkle it onto a female plant and see how many seed you would get. It's good. It tells you exactly how many viable seed can be produced, but the problem is that there are so many other factors that influence whether that seed actually develops. The female could abort the seed, and it has nothing to do with the pollen. So it has some bugs to be worked out if we're going to use that method. We are going to combine the biological data with our physical data that we've been collecting and develop a model that combines the predictions of spatial and temporal movement with the estimates of viability. And it sounds complex, and it is, but it has been done. These two studies have actually been looking at oak pollen, and they've actually developed a very fine, sophisticated model that can do this, and we'd like to apply this to cotton. So someone asked, you know, this is kind of, why are we worried about how far it can move, since it seems like the problem is so pervasive. Isn't it like trying to shut the barn door after the horse has already gotten out? And I'm going to admit, it's not a level playing field. There are millions of pigweed out there every year spreading their pollen about, and then there's one person who's trying to describe it. But there are herbicide resistance needs that we need to be aware of. Herbicide resistance, particularly in the state of Georgia, is pervasive, but we do have susceptibility, and we do have to maintain those pockets of susceptibility. So we need this information to encourage the farmers that they need to engage in resistance management practices, and it's easier if you can say, you know what, it can move this far, and there's a good chance that this pollen is still alive when it gets here, and that it's going to be able to, you're going to have gene flow from this resistant population to this susceptible population, and you're going to have yourselves even more of a problem on your hands. And I know Stanley has used the data to show the farmers exactly what we're facing, and that it's not isolated problems throughout the state. We do have the potential for multiple resistance, and if we do have this, it'd be good to know what's the chance that we're now going to have this multiple resistance traits that are combined into a genetic combination moving. And it's also going to allow us to quickly understand genetic mutation and gene flow and how they're altering populations. I don't think that Palmer amaranth is going to stop being a problem anytime soon, and I'm sure there's going to be more problems, particularly if some other herbicide resistance begins to develop. And also, this isn't going to be the end of herbicide resistance in species in general. So this is a bit esoteric, perhaps academic, but this is information that's going to help the society and the science as a whole to try and understand how these problems are arising. In conclusion, I'd like to thank those corporations, companies that are providing the economic support for this experiment.
Questions for our speaker. So you're going to make me ask another question. How far does the pollen move?
How far does the pollen move? Well, I wasn't prepared to quite give that out. We have several experiments looking at pollen movement. We have one in the field, and of course, a pollen movement as defined by a field experiment. We're constrained by the size of the field and our surroundings, but it easily moved from the center of a field out to about 200 meters in every direction. And there was still a lot of resistance at the furthest distances, but that tail is just too hard to capture when you're talking, you know, Macon County and the level of resistance in the background. We have done some theoretical work, and you're looking at hundreds of kilometers. And I actually ran it by, I'm from Ohio State, so no comments, but I ran it by faculty at Ohio State that I work with, and they felt I was underestimating pollen dispersal. So.
So you're assuming that the susceptible and the resistant are the same. Is that right?
Whether susceptible and resistant move the same? Yes. I have not seen any difference in size, density, shape, or any characteristic that would alter flight.
Any other questions for our speaker? Let's thank our speaker.